This recording is the property of the Winogrand Foundation, cannot be copied, rebroadcast, or otherwise distributed without the express permission of the Foundation. This is New York Academy of Sciences Anthropology Section Lecture Series at the Foundation for November 17th, 2014. Tonight's presentation is an immigration and activism panel featuring Dr. Daniel Goldstein of Rutgers University and Dr. Alicia Galvez of Lehman College.
Okay, I think we're just about ready to start. Let's sit quietly. Okay, well, welcome to Winogrand, and thank you for braving the damp weather outside. I'm not entirely sure who's going to introduce this. Is it Brian? Janice? Okay, and I'm Leslie Aiello. I'm the president of the foundation. We're very happy to host the New York Academy of Science. So, Janice.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, and also, anybody that spills red wine on the carpet will never get funded. So watch it.
Okay, good evening, everyone, and welcome. My name is Janice Sotokoff, and I and my colleague Brian Boyd here are the co-chairs of the Anthropology Section of New York Academy of Sciences. This evening, we have our panel on immigration and activism, which is part of our migration lecture series this semester. We're thrilled this evening to hear two prize-winning anthropologists, Alicia Galvez of Lehman College CUNY and Daniel Goldstein of Rutgers University, whose research interests have different trajectories yet converge around the experiences of Latin American immigrants in the United States struggling to defend their rights, to achieve legal status, to live together with their families, and to live a dignified life. Alicia Galvez is an associate professor of Latin American, Latino, and Puerto Rican studies at Lehman College. She is also the founding director of the CUNY Institute of Mexican Studies at Lehman College, where 43% of the student body is Latino. The Institute is described as the first academic institute east of the Mississippi devoted to Mexican and Mexican-American studies. It's with a mission to boost enrollment of Mexican and Mexican-American students around the Bronx. It affirms the importance of the study of immigrant experience and distinct cultural identity, and this was really launched in 2012, 2013, at a time when ethnic studies institutes were under attack. As in Arizona, when the Tucson School District canceled its Mexican-American Studies program because it ostensibly taught students to resent Anglos, and when Naomi Shaver Riley wrote an inflammatory blog post about the illegitimacy of black studies as an academic discipline in the Chronicle of Higher Education. Alicia has written numerous articles as well as two books on Mexican immigration in New York. Her first book, Guadalupe in New York, Devotion and the Struggle for Citizenship Rights Among Mexican Immigrants, published by New York University Press in 2009, examines how Catholicism has helped Mexican immigrants in New York find the will and words to push for immigration reform and respect. Her second book, Patient Citizens, Immigrant Mothers, Mexican Women, Public Prenatal Care, and the Birth of Weight Paradox, published by Rutgers University Press in 2011, investigates the Latina health paradox that Mexican immigrant women have less complicated pregnancies and more favorable birth outcomes than many other groups, in spite of socioeconomic disadvantage. The book examines the experiences of Mexican immigrant women during pregnancy and childbirth in the public health care system of New York City. This book won the 2012 award from the Association of Latino and Latin American Anthropologists. Beyond her roles as a scholar, Alicia has worked for community-based organizations in New York City as a volunteer and an advocate for immigrant rights with Asociación Tepeyac, Mano a Mano, Mexican Culture Without Borders, the Lehman Dream Team, and as co-founder of the Dream Act Faculty Alliance. Daniel Goldstein of Rutgers Anthropology Department is a political and legal anthropologist who also works as an activist for immigrant workers and their families' rights. He's an executive board member of the New Jersey-based organization Casa Freehold, and on a cold day in December 2013, he was arrested, along with seven others protesting Obama's immigration policy, while lying down on the road in front of the Elizabeth Detention Center in New Jersey, attempting to block the deportation of other men and women federal immigration authorities consider illegal. In Bolivia, Daniel has established an anthropological field school and service learning program for Rutgers undergraduates at his long-term field site of Cochabamba, where he's taken groups of students to work there over 5 summers. His fieldwork in Bolivia has focused on ideas and practices of security, democracy, and human rights, particularly as these concern Bolivians who have been marginalized from the indigenous rights discourse of Evo Morales' state and whose efforts to make their lives secure or to make justice by one's own hands have been deemed illegal. He's the author of numerous articles and several books. His first monograph is The Spectacular City, Violence and Performance in Urban Bolivia, published by Duke in 2004. In 2010, he co-edited with Desmond Arias, Violent Democracies in Latin America. In 2012, his second monograph, titled Outlawed, Between Security and Rights in a Bolivian City, was published by Duke. This book was awarded the Anthony Leeds Prize in Urban Anthropology in 2013. So the format for this evening is that Alicia Galvez will speak first for about 25 minutes, and then Daniel Goldstein will speak for 25 minutes, and then we'll open it up to question and answers. So please allow me to introduce now our first speaker, Alicia Galvez, with her talk entitled Vampire Capitalism, New Guises of Colonialism in a Post-Labor and Post-Migration Age. Thank you.
Thank you, Janice and Brian, for the invitation tonight. It's an honor to be here. And this is my first disclaimer that this is a new project. So I'm hoping that tonight will serve as a nice workshop opportunity. So let's see. I guess this is Ruben Figueroa, migrant rights activist from the state of Veracruz, described a light bulb moment for Mexico's organized crime organizations. For years, migrants from Central America and Southern Mexico passed by riding atop the freight trains, colloquially called La Bestia, that passed just behind the home Figueroa shared with his mother and siblings. The family always came out of their home when they heard the rumble of the train's approach, and scrambling towards the tracks, passed tamales, sandwiches, and plastic bags with water to the migrants as they went by. In spite of widespread kidnappings, crime, and corruption by gangs, cartels, and law enforcement agencies and other sectors, migrants at the time still largely passed through Mexico unmolested. They were, Figueroa said, too poor to bother with. Sonia Nazario documents that view in her book, In Enrique's Journey, when she quotes a municipal police chief in Nuevo Laredo who, she notes, doubts that even his corrupt officers would pick poor migrants to rob. He tells her, any smart people would seek out someone with more money, gold, chains, clothes. But already a dramatic shift was underway. In 2010, 72 Central American migrants were kidnapped en masse and held for ransom, then executed. La Bestia became a rolling cash machine for all variety of organized crime, whether it was stealing the last coins migrants hid in their shoes, charging a toll for safe passage, or grabbing the phone numbers of family members in order to extort ransom. The light bulb was on. Even the poorest of the region's poor could be a source of revenue. Accompanying the realization that the poor could generate profits is another innovation, that profit can be generated not solely or even mainly from their labor, but from the poor's bodies. No longer were they limited to participating in the market as workers, but their existence, consumption, and taking up of space in the world would be used to generate profits. This is made possible by the commodification of various specific acts of being, moving through space and subsistence. It's a kind of capitalism that is comparable to prior variants in its amoral quest for profit, but is innovative in that it locates profit not only in territorial expansion of markets or minimization of labor and raw materials costs, but in the bodies of the poor. It's a vampire capitalism, voraciously suctioning profit from the poor and extracting surplus value whether or not they work. Just as vampires of legend seek blood through seduction, this is most successful when its victims move toward it, seek it out, and willingly participate in it. But seduction's not necessary. It will go where they live. So migrants are the first line and are the most vulnerable. It's in the predations on migrant bodies that we see the most visible and obvious and yet least mourned acts of vampire capitalism. However, increasingly, we see that the poor need not migrate to fall prey. The poor in communities that have seen a reduction in migration are still visited by this. It swoops in to neutralize in three ways. One, it eliminates surplus bodies. Two, it recategorizes them as a threat and therefore subject to violence or neutralization. And finally, it pressures people into consumption, which in turn may lessen the demands that they make in other areas of life. Today, I'm going to try to touch on all three areas. So I'm not the first to use the vampire as a metaphor for capitalism. Marx himself, Smith, Voltaire, and more recently, Malkinson, Harbin, Taibbi with his vampire squid metaphor for Goldman Sachs, have used vampires as a metaphor for capitalism's voracious capacity to consume workers. But typically, this has been used to describe the relationship between capital and labor. For Marx, capital is dead labor, the life force, the productive energy of the worker extracted for the benefit and profit of the capitalist. Today, I'm going to sketch out a very preliminary description of vampire capitalism and contextualize it within what I see as the formation of a post-migration and post-labor Mexico. This work is the first foray into a new project, and today's talk is a preliminary, even possibly premature peek, as I'm beginning fieldwork on this project. But in the project overall, I examine ways that policies as diverse as NAFTA, the U.S. Farm Bill, food subsidies, trade protections, tariffs, and more have altered foodways in both countries, and show that the rise in diabetes and diet-related illnesses, along with farm subsidies, migration, remittances, corporate business practices, and anti-poverty programs represent the intertwining of very specific and traceable trends and tendencies and business practices, bilateral relations, and ideas about the role and responsibilities of the public and private sectors, individuals, and governments. But first, I want to show you a couple more monsters. It's no surprise that popular culture and narratives intertwine with the structural changes identified by scholars. In the year 2000, I was conducting research in the northern desert region of Chile, the former nitrate mining region, and what today a location that is a source of the great portion of that nation's wealth in the form of copper, gold, and other minerals. This was the region in which Chile's political parties and labor unions were formed, but it is also where the military regime detained, tortured, and executed political prisoners. When I was there in 2000, following confraternal social organizations that participated in an annual Marian festival in an ordinarily small and sleepy village called La Tirana, I learned that the festival had very nearly been canceled due to fears over recent sightings of the chupacabra, in case you don't remember what the chupacabra looks like. A mythical creature blamed for the deaths of livestock and human beings who had been found sucked dry. But where were they found? The vast majority of evidence of the chupacabra was found in areas associated with the mining industry of the region. Chile's wealth for the last century and a half has been largely extracted from that region, most of that time by U.S. and Canadian mining firms. The spatial characteristics of the extraction regime are marked by the extreme desolation of the Atacama Desert, the driest in the world, which is pockmarked by current mining operations and obsolete ones, the ghost town-like abandoned nitrate mining settlements. Workers typically live in coastal cities and are bused for week-long shifts up into the desert highlands. Traveling in the evening or in the pre-dawn darkness, it was these travelers who were targeted by the chupacabra, those obliged to leave their homes and families for work, work which would usually not include the opportunity for advancement, and which included exposure to respiratory ailments and other hazards. At greatest risk of the chupacabra were, in fact, the security guards at the mining operations, those employed to guard the delineation between those included and those excluded from the productive labor of the mines. And there are certainly parallels that can be drawn between the chupacabras of Chile's mining regions and Taussig's devils and other examples in anthropology. Today, we see in the U.S. a popular culture obsession with zombies, usually characters in a post-apocalyptic dystopian wasteland where people have to reinvent communities of the living, often by relearning lost arts of hunting and gathering, farming, and perimeter surveillance. Dystopia is increasingly characterized as a post-market terra nova, where human relationships are reduced to their most elemental. We can see in these myths the specter of hypertrophied and voracious market forces that loom over mundane human interactions and activities. In the response to them, we see an effort to reclaim physical and social spaces for the use of ordinary and mortal humans, and a commentary about the forces that impinge on individual and collective agency. So now to turn to Mexico, I want to examine first how vampire capitalism thrives on the disappearance of certain kinds of people. The faucet turned off between 2008 and 2010. Net migration from Mexico was found to have reached zero in 2012. Slightly higher numbers migrated to Mexico from the U.S. than to the U.S. from Mexico. Opinions differ as to the cause. Increased border security and risk associated with crossing, increased economic opportunity in Mexico, and frustration with lack of immigration reform, lower birth rates in Mexico, higher educational levels and development. It's clear that Mexican migration is no longer a one-way flow, and some have predicted that it will never return to its historically high levels. If Mexico is now in a post-migration era, the push factors that promoted migration in the past, chief among them poverty, must have been alleviated now. Actually, poverty in Mexico has not fallen and by many measures is growing. Inequality has increased, with the number of billionaires in Mexico growing and acquiring larger shares of the nation's wealth, while the minimum wage is in effect 18.5% less than it was 20 years ago. The North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect in January 1994 with promises to transform Mexico. In the words of then-President Carlos Salinas Gortari, the agreement would clearly regulate the growing commerce between the two countries, foster investment, and create jobs. He said it would bring an end to poverty and migration and begin La Gran Época del Campo Mexicano, the golden age of the Mexican countryside. The transformation of the Mexican countryside was anticipated, according to those present at the negotiation, to mean that 500,000 campesinos would leave subsistence farming and other rural occupations for jobs in manufacturing. In reality, 500,000 people per year for the next decade migrated to the United States, and even more were displaced to the cities and in the countryside itself, with lands lying fallow due to a lack of cultivation and irrigation. In spite of the plan to relocate, to relocate productivity, the transnational movement of workers was not to be negotiated. Luis Ernesto Derbez, part of the negotiations and later Mexico's foreign minister, told me regulation of migration was a non-starter in the NAFTA talks. Mexico agreed to take it off the table in order to prevent the complete disintegration of the trade deal. As such, what Mexico might have envisioned as a three-legged stool, a liberalization of the flow of goods, capital, and workers, became a two-legged and very unstable stool. Goods and capital would flow at unprecedented speed and ease, while workers would be obliged to follow jobs at their own expense, shouldering the burden of illegality as they went. But we are seeing that migration is now increasingly passé as an economic strategy. In his futuristic science fiction film, Sleep Dealer, director Alex Rivera depicts a post-migration dystopia where production proceeds at a rapid clip, all the work but none of the workers. Instead of crossing borders, workers travel to local maquilas, where they literally plug into cybernetic transnational servers and mime the work that is being done by humanoid robots in the U.S. So if you haven't seen the film, people put holes in their arms that are sort of ports, and then they plug in these cables, and then they mime work that's being done by robots on the other side of the border. Last month, I asked the ambassador of Mexico to Washington, Eduardo Medina Mora, if Mexico would insist on migration being on the table if NAFTA were to be renegotiated today. He said, no, migration is no longer viewed by either country as central to economic progress, and went on to say that regularization of the status of the existing unauthorized population in the U.S. is a humanitarian and a social question, but not an economic one. On the eve of NAFTA going into effect, President Bill Clinton spoke to his countrymen and said, we cannot stop global change. We cannot repeal the international economic competition that is everywhere. We can only harness the energy to our benefit. Now we must recognize that the only way for a wealthy nation to grow richer is to export, to find new customers for the products and services it makes. It's arguable that this is precisely what has been accomplished in the moment that vampire capitalism was unleashed. The poor have always, of course, been essential to capitalism, but mainly through their labor. The alienation of workers' productive effort at minimal costs is, of course, one of the key operating principles of capitalist modes of production and the driving force behind colonialism. While colonialism opened up new sources of raw materials, workers, and markets, and largely focused on the production of goods for sale in the metropole, to consumers empowered and enabled by their superior position and the hierarchy of capital and labor, while consumption among the poor was minimal and often regulated, as with sumptuary laws. While independence sought to break the lopsided relationship between colony and empire, in many ways what followed was a replication of previous patterns, and we can see within countries dynamics of center and periphery that kept wealth concentrated in the hands of few. While poor workers, largely relegated to the margins of the national landscape and even within metropolitan landscapes, stayed poor. Multinational corporations used national governments to create policies and frameworks favorable to investment. Profit could be made from workers' consumption, think company stores and enclave economies, but it was a bonus, ancillary to the task of provisioning the basic necessities to workers required for their continued labor. Whether chocolate, cigarettes, and white sugar centuries past, or smartphones and sneakers today, it was wealthy countries and the wealthy few within poor countries that were expected to consume the goods produced by the poor, still assumed unable to afford what they had made. The growth of the global middle class that's trumpeted by pro-trade organizations is a process that enthusiastically leaves small and medium-scale agriculture behind in the name of progress, modernization, and development. Monetization of markets and exchange, even in the most rural communities, have meant that consumption is now globalized. Expansion of markets, it could be argued, is now complete in global reach, but still emergent in terms of reach to consumers. Profits can be expected to come from the creation of consumers even more than product diversification. And with technologies for reaching even the most remote communities, smartphones, internet, electronic banking, and more, distance from urban hubs is irrelevant. So too is purchasing power, consumer credit, cash assistance, remittances, and labor force reconfiguration have made everyone a consumer. It is not necessary to earn like the middle class to consume like them. NAFTA has produced and heightened the visibility of surplus bodies, even while it, in conjunction with Mexico's overall development plan, has engineered their disappearance in the long term. Migration was the tool of choice for dealing with surplus workers for most of the 20th century in Mexico. While the trade agreement resulted in an initial flood of new migration, especially between 1995 and 2005, we can see that since then, as migration has tapered off, other changes have been wrought. Mexico's fertility rate was 4.7 in 1980, and only a generation later, it's 2.2 women as of 2012. Social policy promotes smaller family size and higher levels of education as a long-term strategy for reducing poverty. The program formerly called Oportunidades, now called Prospera, is the much-discussed cash incentive program you may remember from when Bloomberg was thinking of implementing it here, that rewards families, mothers specifically, for keeping their children in school, using contraception, and attending well-child visits. However, displacement from the countryside, shifting economic growth sectors, and programs like this have not absorbed a sufficient number of those born between 1985 and 2000. Poverty has grown. We can see the rise here just in the last 7 years. People have not continued to migrate in the same numbers, but they also have not been absorbed into the economy. The crisis is especially acute in the countryside, where old forms of marginalization persist, such as systematic discrimination against indigenous communities, poor infrastructure, limited educational opportunities, and more. As a result, we have what some have called the growing pains of demographic and economic transition. As Mexico has shifted from a rural economy to a service and manufacturing economy, temporary imbalances and displacements are, some say, to be expected. But increasingly, the promised rewards of the social and economic upheaval are not reaching those who have been most violently displaced. Without having entered the middle class, their consumption, even of the most basic elements of life, food, water, education, healthcare, and services, is commodified and privatized, with multinational corporations best situated to rake in the proceeds. It is becoming clear that even Sleep Dealer, the dystopian science fiction film about labor migrants who do not migrate to labor, was not dystopian enough, as it is now possible for the poor to consume and not labor at all. Recategorization. So I have a somewhat long section, which I'm going to condense in the interest of time, about the current situation in Ayotzinapa. I'm going to assume basic knowledge of the situation in Mexico, where 43 students from a teacher's college were stopped by armed police, detained, and then turned over to local drug gangs who apparently killed them and burned them and buried their remains, but their remains have yet to be found with conclusive DNA evidence. But in the process of searching for their remains, dozens of other anonymous mass graves have been uncovered in the region. The students were preparing for careers that would have them return to their own or similar communities to teach. On the surface, because they were students and not migrants, they represented a victory in Mexico's social and economic transformation, of which trade policy and NAFTA is a single piece. It was the explicit goal of the Mexican state to grow the economy and shrink the population enough so that opportunity and labor could be better matched than it was in the 1990s. Migration could taper off as the economy would better absorb workers into the new economic sectors of manufacturing, service, and technology. But there is a phrase, entre dicho y hecho, hay mucho trecho. There's a long stretch between what is said and what is done. And the students were living in the trecho, in the gap between the proposed future economy and an older version of Mexico. And ultimately, that gap was violently closed. In the violent, even cannibalistic destruction of the bodies of the students, those who reject the larger moves toward consumption and monetization of social life are recategorized as criminals. Ayotzinapa is a bloody, embarrassing, scandalous revelation of a larger ongoing trend. Those who do not fit, who cannot be absorbed into the economy and are no longer migrating, and perhaps most importantly because they were activists, Marxist student activists no less, they rejected the new roles outlined for them. The spectacle of the missing students is horrifying, but even the initial evidence indicates that not even the scale of this act is unprecedented. Writer Francisco Goldman wrote that since Calderon, the former president, began a war with the cartels, the whole of Mexico has become a narcofosa, a narco grave, a meme that has circulated quite a bit on the social networks. The trickle of bodies that has characterized the news every day has been chilling and has generated outrage, pain, fear, and disgust. Lately, the narco machine, as Rosano Reguillo calls it, has revved up to new levels. Its ties to the state have become ever more visible and evident. It enables the state to legitimately ramp up its own violence, unless it be seen as engaging in a futile and high-stakes game of whack-a-mole, and invest in ever more elaborate and expensive weapons and maneuvers to destroy cartel leadership and disrupt operations. The intermingling of state and extra-state functions and violence achieves a rejection in surplus bodies in two ways that are aligned with the larger reorganization of the Mexican economy. First, the narco fosas, the narco graves, are evidence of the large-scale disappearance of vast numbers of Mexicans and also non-Mexicans. The explicit disappearance of students while protesting is more likely a revelation of a longer-standing strategy, a slipping away of the veil, than a departure in methods. If poverty has not been reduced and migration has, Mexico is faced with a potentially incendiary situation. The targeting of young people for violence, the same young people made redundant by the changing economy, serves to deliver the message that they must get out of the way of the wheels of progress or be run over by them. And it's telling that the president, Enrique Peña Nieto, this was on the social networks, he was named by Time magazine as the savior of Mexico. And this, it was immediately taken up, actually. Not, this isn't from now only. This, when that came out, artists immediately started making plays on all the things that he was besides the savior of Mexico. But it's telling that he left the country as soon as the revelations of the death of the students were made by the attorney general to go to a trade conference in China. The targeting of young people for violence, the same young people made redundant by the... Secondly, the ongoing drug war serves to criminalize and therefore justify disappearance of anyone who is affiliated with the narco machine. So in 2011, Francisco Mancha, an anthropologist from the City University of Mexico, delivered a presentation at CUNY on the current state of affairs in Zacatecas, a state that is a de rigueur transit corridor for drug trafficking from south to north through Mexico. Youth, he said, were being sent unaccompanied to the U.S. by families in fear that they would be recruited as mules or assassins by the narco machine. Today, just a few years later, they're migrating in far smaller numbers from this region because migration today is less a method of evading the narco machine than a delivery into it. So youth are trying to continue to make their lives amidst the heightened violence. Damned if they do, damned if they don't, youth are targeted and persecuted by the narcos and subject to violence, kidnappings, and extortion if they don't wish to join, and by the state if they do. Those who are affiliated even in any way, even adopting the sartorial preferences of narcos that have come to dominate in many regions of Mexico, are persecuted as criminals. Prominent writer Juan Villoro has said that Mexico is on the verge of a social explosion if it continues to criminalize the youth instead of giving them opportunities. But the social explosion can surely be evaded if enough youth are criminalized and targeted, because who would be left to lead the explosion? The structural critique leveled by the very existence of too many young people for too few jobs, and their more explicit critique via protests, their rejection of the new market-oriented place for them, is rendered inaudible, and they are silenced, whether as victims or as perpetrators, is moot. So in the interest of time, I think I'll have to have 1 minute. I think I'll have to skip my last section. So I'll just very quickly go through a couple of these slides. Essentially, in the next section, I analyze changes in food practices and food provision towards what some scholars have called a supermarketization. Essentially, through anti-poverty programs, Mexico has now shifted in two significant ways. One, in direct services to the poor, conditional cash transfers, which put cash into the hands of people who very recently in the past were subsistence farmers, but now have cash to consume in the market. And they get more cash for doing more things that are putting them further away from farming, so keeping their children in school, having smaller families, taking their children to the doctor. Multinational corporations have seized on this. This is Teddy Roosevelt, who's very famous foreign policy towards Latin America was summed up, walk softly and carry a big stick. And here we have a play on Obama. So we have these lobbying agencies. This is the biggest one in Mexico, which promotes product diversification and promotes marketing opportunities and opportunities for U.S. Multinational food corporations to sell products in Mexican supermarkets. And the son of the founder of this was named Secretary of Health for the country, in spite of having only a master's degree in business, not a medical degree. And under his watch, actually preceding it, and since then, we've seen sort of a massive shift in the kinds of calories consumed and the amount of the budget that's spent on processed foods with really awful health consequences, public health consequences in terms of metabolic syndrome and diet-related chronic illnesses. To kind of bring in the activism piece, there are definitely large social movements that are attempting to reclaim farming practices such as maize cultivation and eating practices as well. So thank you very much.
Our next speaker is Daniel Goldstein, who will now present his talk, E-Terrify, Electronic Surveillance of the Immigrant Worker in Obama's America.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting me to speak tonight. I have exactly one slide. And there it is. Enjoy it for the next 25 minutes. The homeland is in grave danger, people. That was my opening line. The homeland is in grave danger, people, and it's all because of immigration. Thank you very much. Or so it would seem from reading the newspapers and listening to some of our politicians tell it. The border with Mexico is wide open, critics of the Obama administration say, making us vulnerable to a range of terrorist threats. They claim that agents of ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, are conspiring to sneak across our unprotected southern border to cause instability and imperil the nation. The conservative group Judicial Watch recently issued a statement claiming that, quote, Islamic terrorist groups are operating in the Mexican border city of Ciudad Juarez and planning to attack the United States with car bombs or other vehicle-borne improvised explosive devices, end quote. Governor Rick Perry of Texas, a likely candidate for president in 2016, has also suggested that, quote, individuals from ISIS or other terrorist states could be exploiting the insecurity of the border, saying that, quote, I think it's a very real possibility that they may have already crossed into the U.S. Even more alarming, some suggest that ISIS fighters are planning to expose themselves to the Ebola virus prior to crossing over, with the goal of infecting the U.S. population. Tom Tillis, newly elected senator from North Carolina, put it like this in a pre-election debate, quote, ladies and gentlemen, we've got an Ebola outbreak. We have bad actors that can come across the border. We need to seal the border and secure it, end quote. Scott Brown, running for the Senate in New Hampshire, expressed concern that undocumented immigrants from Mexico could bring the Ebola virus into the U.S., as did Representative Phil Gingrey of Georgia, who in a letter to the CDC referenced, quote, reports of illegal migrants carrying deadly diseases such as swine flu, dengue fever, Ebola virus, and tuberculosis, end quote. Never mind that Mexico has never seen a case of the Ebola virus, or that there have been no documented cases of immigrants with Ebola attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. Never mind that even Governor Perry admits that, quote, we have no clear evidence of ISIS being present in Mexico. Never mind that the border is more secure now than at any time in recent history, or that in the last few years the number of migrant deaths in the desert and of detentions and deportations reached an all-time high. What matters here are the fears that can be so easily stoked through acts of the political imagination. As Trent Franks, representative from Arizona, said recently, quote, if unaccompanied minors can cross the border, then certainly trained terrorists probably can too, end quote. Certainly, probably. It is difficult to argue with such logic and the easy slippage from terrorist to immigrant that it enables. The political power of the fearful imagination has a long history in this country as part of the public discourse about immigration. As medical historian Howard Markle has observed, quote, Chinese immigrants were once linked to bubonic plague and hookworm, Mexicans were thought to be infested with lice, and Russian Jews were seen as somehow especially vulnerable to tuberculosis, and a favorite wastebasket diagnosis of nativists in the early 1900s, poor physique. These ideas contributed to the passage of racist, restrictive immigration laws at different points in the 20th century, much as they underlie calls for the closure of the border with Mexico today. If a fearful imaginary motivates non-migrant citizens' support for racist policies of migrant exclusion, other technologies of fear target migrants themselves. Scholars of immigration in the contemporary U.S. have recognized that, as the border with Mexico has become increasingly militarized and secured, despite the claims of Republican politicians like those cited above, the locus of immigration policing has shifted away from the southern frontier to the spaces within the country, the places where undocumented migrants live and work. The U.S. government has reconfigured immigration policing through such instruments as Section 287G of the Immigration and Nationality Act, which deputizes state and local law enforcement officials to carry out the work of border control in their jurisdictions. The Obama administration's program called Secure Communities allows the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division, ICE, of the Department of Homeland Security to further penetrate local settings. Under Secure Communities, all those arrested for any offense are biometrically screened for immigration violations. A positive hit for such a violation results in ICE issuing a detainer, a request to local authorities that the individual be held for up to 48 hours to allow ICE to determine if an order of removal should be issued. Secure Communities gives ICE a technological, not physical, presence in prisons and jails, and so represents a kind of virtual policing of the immigrant. Intended to target quote, criminal aliens, those who pose a threat to public safety, and repeat immigration violators, as well as the most dangerous and violent offenders, end quote. Secure Communities has served not only to detain and deport hundreds of thousands of people guilty of no crime other than being in the country without authorization. It has also resulted in the detention and sometimes deportation of documented immigrants and citizens of color. Programs and technologies of detection and screening that allow for greater policing of immigrants living in the interior of the U.S. raise levels of anxiety and fear among immigrants who drive cars, send their children to school, walk the streets, or work outside the home. And with good reason, the Obama administration has deported upwards of 2 million people, more than all previous administrations combined. There's another level of border internalization that I want to call attention to here, the internalization of border regulation into migrant bodies and selves, a process of subjectification of what we might call the non-citizen subject. While the production of the citizen subject is often theorized as the object of the neoliberal democratic state, we can here suggest that it is also the non-citizen subject who is produced through a variety of mechanisms and techniques, including forms of self-disciplining that are key components of neoliberal governmentality. Immigration laws and technologies of legal regulation, I argue, identify migrant subjectivity as the battleground on which the war for immigration enforcement and border control is waged. And fear, implemented through these policies and technologies of governance, is a powerful weapon of the state in waging that war. In central New Jersey, for example, where I've been conducting ethnographic fieldwork since 2011, I have observed the production of the non-citizen subject through fear in a variety of settings. New Jersey is an interesting state in which to study immigration, in large part due to its history as a collection of autonomous municipalities, complicating any attempt to generalize about the state as a whole. In terms of immigration law, some New Jersey towns are highly securitized, with restrictive municipal ordinances that limit undocumented migrants' ability to work, rent property, or own businesses, while others are sanctuary cities that exhibit a welcoming stance toward migrants. The overall effect in the state is thus that of a patchwork of contiguous and non-overlapping political, legal, and social milieus through which migrants move in the course of their daily rounds of work, school, socializing, and home. My research and activist work are based in a central New Jersey borough I call Hometown, a pseudonym that both resonates ironically with the ubiquitous Homeland Security and indexes the Bruce Springsteen song of the same name, My Hometown. Springsteen was born and raised in central New Jersey. Parts of Hometown look like classic middle America. There is a historic Main Street, a stately courthouse with white pillars fronting a trim green lawn, and many beautiful old homes with porch swings and American flags out front. But Hometown also has a diverse population of about 15,000 non-migrant white and African-American residents and about 8,000 Latino immigrants, mostly Mexicans, but also Peruvians, Guatemalans, and others. In 2003, the borough tried to impose harsh laws to prohibit people from gathering publicly to wait for work, as immigrant men do in their muster zones around town, as well as a series of restrictions that made it difficult for migrants to rent and occupy apartments in town. A group of local residents and activists challenged these laws in federal court and won. In the aftermath, Hometown Borough has become a relatively welcoming place for immigrants to reside, and many of the people I know express a strong sense of security about living there. But Hometown Borough is part of the New Jersey patchwork of municipalities, and the policies and politics of one town have implications for others. Hometown Borough is an island in the sea of Hometown Township, another municipality that completely surrounds the borough of the same name. Hometown Borough is the hole in the township's donut, and the two places couldn't be more different. Whereas Hometown Borough is relatively tolerant of immigrants, Hometown Township is not. Migrant residents of the borough do not like to enter the township for fear of being stopped by the police on any imaginable pretext. Driving with a busted taillight, for example, or riding with too many people in the car, or riding your bike on the sidewalk, or loitering, that is, waiting for work in the parking lot of a convenience store, can be enough to get you arrested. And once you are arrested, you are fed into ICE, into the ICE computer via Secure Communities, and from there it is a short step to detention and deportation. Nor do people entirely trust the police of Hometown Borough. Though undocumented migrants express a surprising confidence in the local authorities and will even call the police in times of trouble, they nevertheless try to avoid unnecessary contact with them and with situations that might bring them unwanted exposure to the federal immigrant detection system. Migrant residents of hometown thus adopt a range of behavioral self-monitoring techniques to limit the risk of detention. Some of these are learned passively through observing other migrants or one's parents and friends. Others are explicitly taught. Experienced migrants instruct new arrivals on how to comport themselves to avoid detection. A friend named Meyer told me that when he first came to hometown, his cousin taught him the rules. Don't drink, he told him, because alcohol can make you noisy or violent, and either way the cops may be called. Don't go to parties for the same reason. Don't shoplift. It may seem like a small thing, but if you're caught, you can be deported. Don't go out after dark when your presence on the street may attract attention. And so on. CASA Hometown, a local immigrant rights advocacy organization with which I have worked for several years, also teaches people how to be safe. In formal classes and informal conversations, immigrants are told that they don't have to open their doors to the cops if they come around, that they shouldn't sign any forms they don't understand. Immigrants are often tricked into signing their own deportation papers, that they don't have to give out any information about themselves to the authorities. They are instructed to create an emergency plan for their citizen children in case they themselves are detained or deported. Through these trainings, migrants try to manage themselves and their behaviors, ironically striving to become good, law-abiding non-citizens who go to church, avoid drink, try to learn English, and don't make any demands on the authorities. Meanwhile, authorities seeking to regulate the immigrant presence in the U.S. have similarly targeted the internal world of the migrant for disciplining. This is best illustrated through the logic of self-deportation, the idea that if conditions are made so unpleasant for undocumented people in this country, they will decide to pick up and go home on their own. Many of the harshest anti-immigrant laws passed in recent years in such states as Alabama, Georgia, and Arizona have made self-deportation an explicit object of state law, identifying it as a cost-effective technique involving minimal state effort, and hence an ideal neoliberal policy prescription to rid the state of an unwanted migrant presence. Chris Kobach, Kansas Secretary of State and counsel for the anti-immigration group FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, has said, quote, "There haven't been mass arrests. There aren't a bunch of court proceedings. People are simply removing themselves. It's self-deportation at no cost to the taxpayer. I'd say that's a win." End quote. Mitt Romney made self-deportation the foundation of his immigration policy during his 2012 presidential campaign, saying people decide they can do better by going home because they can't find work here, because they don't have legal documentation to allow them to work here. Although administration officials don't use the term, self-deportation continues to be a key element of federal immigration programs under the Obama administration. The targeting of migrant subjectivity through fear is basic to this approach. One powerful technology through which fear is generated among the undocumented is called E-Verify, a tool for what is known as worksite employment eligibility enforcement. Since the passage of the Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA, of 1986, federal law has prohibited employers from knowingly hiring people not authorized to work in this country, inserting the federal government into the employer-employee relationship, and effectively deputizing business and private sector employers as immigration control officers. Begun as a pilot program in the mid-1990s, the technology for screening employee identities was dubbed E-Verify in 2007. A non-compulsory program, E-Verify is available through a website operated by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, a department of the DHS. The technology checks individuals against databases of the DHS and the Social Security Administration to confirm that an individual is legally authorized to work in this country. The program is largely intended for use by employers, but potential employees may also use the system through an online self-check program. The E-Verify website is remarkably free of politics, and no reference is made to immigrants or immigration. I've not even been able to find a statement describing the ultimate goals of the E-Verify program or what it is intended to achieve. The website does contain a strong privacy statement, somewhat odd under the circumstances, claiming that quote, E-Verify is committed to protecting your privacy and civil liberties with the same rigor that the DHS places on protecting our homeland, end quote. Nevertheless, the technology's goal is self-deportation is unequivocal. Chris Kobach of Kansas and FAIR, in a 2008 Law Journal article advocating for the national expansion of E-Verify, put it this way, quote, illegal aliens can be encouraged to depart the United States on their own through a concerted strategy of attrition through enforcement. Illegal aliens are rational decision makers. If the risks of detention or involuntary removal go up and the probability of being able to obtain unauthorized employment goes down, then at some point, the only rational decision is to return home, end quote. The undocumented immigrant as a rational actor frames the target of E-Verify as a terrain of zero-sum games, in which the E-Verify technology quietly and cost-effectively tips the balance in the direction of self-deportation. This perspective conflicts with our ethnographic findings. To argue that undocumented people will elect to go home if confronted with a system that requires a valid social security number to access employment is to misunderstand what motivates many immigrants to come to the U.S. As Clemencia, a friend from hometown, said, quote, we come to this country to provide for our families. We know it will be a sacrifice, but we are willing to make that sacrifice to ensure that our family will have a better life, end quote. While some undocumented immigrants may make the decision to go back to their country, most of them don't opt for self-deportation simply because it would impose even greater struggles on them and their families, returning them to the bleak economic conditions that prompted their migration in the first place. In this context, E-Verify, like the highly securitized U.S.-Mexico border, does not keep people away from places like hometown, but rather makes them more afraid, and therefore more prone to exploitation and abuse by intensifying the threat of deportation. Indeed, even though E-Verify is not explicitly designed to deport undocumented immigrants, but rather to make them ineligible for employment, people who spend their lives in fear of La Migra are threatened by a program that requires them to present their Social Security card to their employer and risk being outed as undocumented. Sylvia, one of our interviewees, in talking about the hesitation she felt when asked by her employer of 13 years to present her Social Security card so her information could be entered into E-Verify, told us that, quote, that she, quote, became very afraid of immigration. After 13 years, it was a difficult decision to present my papers, end quote. Sylvia decided not to resign and instead submitted the fake Social Security card she bought 20 years ago, right after arriving in hometown. Miraculously, her Social Security number was accepted by the system, and she was able to keep her job. Not everyone is as lucky as Sylvia was, though. Many people lose their jobs once their data is processed. Others simply resign when asked for their papers. But the choice to quit does not translate into an option for self-deportation. Rather, losing their jobs due to E-Verify destabilizes people's employment security. It forces them to move from one job to the next, or to search for jobs for which the employer won't be using E-Verify. New Jersey, unlike some other states, does not yet mandate the use of E-Verify, introducing another kind of patchwork to the mix in which some employers opt to use the technology while others do not. These jobs usually consist of domestic or construction day labor and are significantly more precarious than the stable, if often barely adequate, biweekly paychecks offered by more formal employers. Another response to E-Verify is to find real papers. As another informant told us, quote, a solution to E-Verify is to buy someone's Social Security number. But then that can be even worse because using someone else's social is a crime. If you're caught, the dream will turn into a nightmare, end quote. Paradoxically, in forcing the immigrant worker to circumvent the system, E-Verify can force her to abandon her attempts to be the good non-citizen subject and push her towards criminal behavior as a strategy for survival. It also exposes her to greater vulnerability from abusive employers who can use the threat of E-Verify to cow workers into accepting subminimum wages, extended hours, or dangerous working conditions. These factors, in turn, increase the instability of her situation and augment her feelings of insecurity. These feelings of insecurity are not only linked to the fear of being detained and deported. Juana, who lost her job due to E-Verify, told us, quote, this really affected me both emotionally and economically. I have 3 kids, and I had a good job that helped me provide for them. I now have to start from zero and get used to a totally different job. I was making $16 an hour. Going back to making $8 an hour deeply affects me and my family. I didn't even receive any compensation from my employer after working for her for 17 years. End quote. And this was not her only loss, Juana says. In her own words, quote, with E-Verify, we lose because we can't provide for our families. Employers lose because they won't have people to work for them. And the state of New Jersey loses because even if we have fake papers, we still pay taxes every month. If we Hispanics stop paying taxes, New Jersey has much to lose. End quote. The fear that accompanies E-Verify is intensified by people's lack of knowledge of the legal system. Because there are few venues for undocumented people in hometown to learn about immigration policies and laws, they're often confused as to exactly what E-Verify is. When we asked Yuri if she's ever had to deal with E-Verify, she proceeded to tell us a story about her place of employment being raided by ICE. Quote, E-Verify sent my employer an email saying they'd be checking everyone's papers, and then they showed up at my work asking for our documentation. 2 months later, ICE agents returned and demanded that the employer fire 21 of us, whose social security numbers turned out to be false. End quote. What's interesting about this story is that E-Verify is unrelated to ICE raids. What Yuri perceived to be E-Verify was a routine raid, probably, as her employer ventured, in response to a former employee's finger-pointing. Within the complex network of local and national immigration legislation that undocumented people in hometown have to navigate on a daily basis, E-Verify takes on a life of its own in the minds of the people it targets. It probably won't make them give up the promise of finding prosperity for themselves and their families in the U.S., but they certainly will be more afraid and more vulnerable as a result. And here's my brief conclusion. In an article on undocumented migrants to Israel/Palestine, anthropologist Sarah Willen calls our attention to the biblical book of Jeremiah, in which God declares an intention to enact laws that operate not merely in the external social world, but also by touching upon the innermost dimensions of human activity and experience. I shall put my law into their inward parts, the divine voice declares. This internalization, or the internal, as the latest battleground in the securitization of migration, is what I'm calling out in this presentation. Through technologies like E-Verify, the state attempts to penetrate the inner world of the undocumented migrant, to affect a particular policy outcome by inducing fear within the subject and causing her or him to make choices that appear to be agentive, but are in fact highly overdetermined. In this, E-Verify and other immigration related technologies and programs are not unlike other forms of neoliberal governmentality, which strive to inculcate particular subject dispositions marked by qualities of self-regulation and individual responsibility. Here, the migrant is even expected to become the primary actor responsible for her own removal. As I've shown, however, this works in practice to produce greater vulnerability for migrants and their families already resident in the U.S. without producing the desired effect of self-deportation. For anthropologists of immigration, this discussion also points us in the direction of the internal, the lived daily experience of undocumented people, as a fertile and relatively unexplored domain of research. As anthropologist Willen says, perhaps the connection between legal statuses and statutes on the one hand, and the lived experience of migrants on the other, is far more intimate and far more worthy of investigation than scholars have acknowledged to date. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Daniel. So we'll open it up now to question and answer. The two panelists will sit at the front table. And I can feel the questions. Yes, I'll call on people for you. And yes.
Those were in some ways amazing papers. It was a wonderful session. But I worry particularly with the second paper, but in some ways with both, about two things. One is some more specificity about what kinds of industries get examined. For example, I worked helping to organize Smithfield Hams down in North Carolina, which hires 5,000 people, 30,000 hogs a day. 4,000 of those people are undocumented workers. They told me that the Puerto Rican labor manages so-called Hispanic labor sold them their IDs. The county spent a fortune in subsidies to bring that corporation to North Carolina and Virginia. Nobody's going to dream of looking at who... Okay, so that's one issue of whether this is part, in your liberal sense, of a squeeze against smaller corporations, against small farms, etc., because the bigger operations where the county itself has an investment are never going to get squeezed, are never going to get examined. There's 4,000 guys that work for Smithfield, women, men and women, they're there. Secondly, I think in a perspective, it's unreasonable, to use the strongest term, to look at the situation of Hispanic migrants, undocumented workers from there, from everywhere, without also looking at the situation of African Americans. Mm-hmm. And this is a story people here have heard me tell over and over again, but the director of economic development in this North Carolina county said to me, Jerry, I tell you what, after, this is his exact words, after the colored got civil rights, we had to get rid of them. That's not what colored means. We got rid of them and got Mexicans. So that to look at the whole situation of the harnessing of labor and the simultaneous destruction of labor in the United States, I think it's crucial to look at the situation both of undocumented workers and African Americans simultaneously.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I agree with you on both points. I don't see how that second one is a critique of my paper. Certainly, we have to, in our 25 minutes, draw a line somewhere. But I certainly agree. In terms of E-Verify, you actually see it in New Jersey where, there's a great deal of intergroup tension between Latinos and African Americans. Sometimes, you know, Latinos who have been fired because of E-Verify will say, oh, there was a black worker there who got fired, and then she, to get revenge, told ICE about us, and they sent E-Verify over. And, you know, this reflects, whether that's true or not, it reflects these kinds of intergroup tensions, which have a long history. At the same time, you have a great deal of solidarity between groups in this town, in these kinds of towns, because many of the contemporary African Americans living in these Central Jersey towns are themselves or the children or the grandchildren of African Americans who migrated north during the Great Migration. And they remember some of these same muster zones where Latino immigrants now stand waiting for work. African Americans can themselves remember having stood and worked, looking for work in those same spots. There's been this generational kind of transformation in a way. So yeah, absolutely. And I have a graduate student who's doing exactly this project, because you can, in many ways, connecting with some of what Alicia was talking about, think about the contemporary context of Latino undocumented workers in this country as part of a continuation of the colonial and post-colonial process in the Americas. But again, that's a big framing. About whether this is meant to target small businesses and exempt large businesses, I certainly think you could see it playing out that way. I know that in some states, maybe 20 or so states in the U.S. now, E-Verify is mandatory. It's state law. So every business is supposed to use it, is required to use it. Whether they do, what kind of policing is done with that, I don't know. I'm not sure. That's something for me to continue researching on, because up till now I've mostly done the ethnographic piece, and I think maybe looking at some of the statistics, there's very little information that you can find about how these things are being implemented, how they're actually working out in practice.
I don't know if you want to add anything.
E-Verify is a program of preparing deportation, yeah, it looks like. But they say, immigrants, that this is a way of legalization, something like this. This is my first question. And after this program, deportation numbers increase, of course, yeah. And now it's going up and up.
E-Verify is somewhat distinct from the deportations. because once you're when you're put through E-Verify, you're not turned over to ICE. You're simply not eligible to work. So if you're already employed, you'll be fired. If you're not, if you're looking to be hired, you won't be hired if E-Verify is used. But that won't necessarily initiate a deportation proceeding or get you arrested. People fear that it will because in their minds there's this great – it's often hard to distinguish one technology or one program from another. Separately from E-Verify, though, separately or as part of the whole kind of intensification of immigrant securitization in this country, yes, there has been a tremendous increase in deportations and detentions during the last 6 years since Obama became president. 200, like I said, 2 million in the, under his administration.
Thank you very much for those wonderful papers. I have a question and comment that goes to both of you putting the papers together. I first wanted to talk about the question of fear and E-Verify as a form of neoliberal control. I mean, I think you're right, but I think it goes back to even before this whole system, because the whole question of undocumented labor has always been a system of control through fear. In fact, deportations are the new part, the fear is the old part. So it was a control of labor because people were afraid to complain, you know, unless they formed a social movement. They didn't complain, they hid, they accepted all kinds of conditions. And the immigration authorities knew this. I mean, I interviewed them in early 70s, and they said, we know where all the undocumented are. We're not looking for them. This is worse, you know. So, but now they're looking for them more. So that's part of what we have to theorize also. And that seems to link to changes in how labor is controlled and commodified, and that links to the whole growth of what Nina Sorensen and other people call the migration industry. That's the first paper, Alicia's paper. Because I think you're right, there's a commodification of bodies, you know, and there's a profit making from bodies, and there's a whole industry in which, you know, part of the prison industrial complex, and where bodies are controlled and corralled, and the technology creates profits. The surveillance technology. This is a global issue. So that was the third thing I wanted you to both talk about, is that this is not just Mexico and it's not just the U.S. This is big time issue throughout the EU. You know, in different parts of the UK, the criminalization of youth, the Frontex, the extension of borders into Africa, the rounding up and criminalization of youth. Everywhere, the criminalization of white youth in Europe as well as immigrant youth is part of a phenomenon that I think we have to theorize together. And so talking about zombie capitalism, I think you're absolutely right, but we also need to, I think I'd like you to speak a little bit more about theorizing why you think this is surplus value.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're right, and one of the things that I haven't yet gotten to a point where I could present it today is thinking about some of the ways that migrants are generating tremendous profits in this sort of ecosystem of migration, both in things that people do very voluntarily, whether it's calling cards or money transfer fees or that sort of thing, but also in terms of detention facilities fees and all of that. And I think that the catching point, the thing that has really kind of inflamed the immigration debate in this country is this idea. It centers so often around labor, in terms of, you know, are migrants taking jobs from other people? Are they a net drain or a net contributor to the economy? And then when we hear examples like the the pork company, which, you know, you could hear the exact same thing from peach growers in Georgia, you know, industries where, you know, big business in the Bush era were the ones that were really pushing for immigration reform. The Democrats were not even silent. They were actually anti-immigration reform because of labor concerns. So things have really shifted in really dramatic ways in the last decade and a half. And so I think trying to kind of theorize that, and I'm certainly not done with it, and I appreciate your your comment. I can't pretend to have it cooked. But I think trying to theorize ways that it goes beyond labor, right? So how can we look at all of the different things that the money that's being made without people ever lifting a finger, right? Because I'm also really, you know, concerned and have researched and written a lot about, you know, different moments of exploitation, and labor continues to be a really key central moment. But I've also been concerned, for example, with my pregnancy project. What about the people who don't work, who migrate to mother, to do domestic work in their own homes? You know, how do they fit into this larger puzzle? And so now with this project, you know, I think that there's, definitely, you know, I'm not sure I'm completely correct, but I think there's definitely an argument to be made for us entering into a post-migration economy, at least between Mexico and the U.S. And what will that look like? What will that mean if we're not thinking about migration in terms of an economic discussion? And what does that mean? I mean, I think the first question, which I've started to try to answer, is, well, does that mean that now people no longer need to migrate because they're better off? And, you know, I think that's the argument that the Mexican government likes to make. Oh, people aren't migrating because, you know, we've grown the economy and, you know, NAFTA is a success and we're, you know, people are now working at the Volkswagen plant. And so that's why they're not migrating. But poverty has grown, inequality has grown. And so trying to look at those moments.
One of the things that really interests me about E-Verify is that it is an effective technology to stop people from working. And we know that this country's there's this incredible hypocrisy about immigration, that we require immigrant labor in this country. And if we were to really begin enforcing E-Verify or things like it, and you mentioned Frontex and these sort of in Europe, they're coming up with all these new technologies which are biometric in nature and which will be much more effective if they really want to stop people from working. But they don't, right? I mean, the economy requires this labor. So there's a strange irony there in which for political reasons you have to police, but for economic reasons you don't want to. And how do these technologies enable you or disable you from being able to do that? And will it maybe provoke a kind of a more honest reckoning about what kinds of labor this economy is actually based on?
But neither of you spoke about the turn toward contract labor, you know, which I guess doesn't count in your statistics, but there's vast amounts of bonded, unfree labor going on in Europe and in the U.S.
Well, I mean, I think I did mention that because when people lose their jobs at Burger King or Wendy's or Walmart or wherever it is, they become contract workers essentially, working under the counter. They enter the informal economy basically as day laborers, as domestic workers, as gardeners, and so on. Which is essentially contract work, though, without any sort of contract. They're entirely vulnerable, but it's short-term, it's no benefits, it's underpaid, it's all those sorts of things. So that's kind of the ground floor, right, to which once E-Verify or something else kicks you out of the formal workplace, that's where you end up. And that's a much more vulnerable, as you know, we know from the academic workforce, right, a much more vulnerable place to be.
You may have covered this and I might have missed it, but my impression is that the township has a different kind of economy from the borough, unlike the so-called part-time K occasional workers in shopping and domestic service. So in the township, there are lots of horse farms and orchards and other forms of fairly high level.
Did you penetrate my pseudonym? Is that what you're...
My mother lived in that town. No. So I'm wondering whether you notice any consistent differences in the situation of those two immigrant labor populations.
Yeah, well, people who will live in the borough, right, Poland, the Donut, and employers will come from all around. They even come from New York to pick up workers there because they know that they're going to be standing there and easy to find and so on. And they'll take them to all different parts of the state, including into the township. And you'll find, I know one of my closest, she's actually a woman who I've worked with and trained as a research assistant, was badly injured working on a horse farm in the township. So, and in her case, she was able to, they actually provided housing and so on. And that's another form of control when you've got people living on your property and so on. But, I haven't done a systematic comparison, but you're living in the borough, you're working, you're waiting for work in the borough, but your actual work can be performed anywhere. You know, in the whole region, really. And one other interesting thing to note too is the effect of Hurricane Sandy. That had a major impact on that whole stretch of New Jersey, as it did in Staten Island and other places. But the immigrant workforce based in central New Jersey was very instrumental in going out to all of those affected regions, just as the immigrant workforce was very instrumental in rebuilding New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And there were huge amounts of deportations following Hurricane Katrina because undocumented people came from all over the country to work in the cleanup, and then once the cleanup was done, they were deported, many of them. So that's been something that another effect within the state of New Jersey, looking at disaster capitalism. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm.
I just wondered if Alicia, you could say another word or two about the demographic transition in Mexico, and if that enters into the discourse about the end of migration.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's it's on everyone's lips when they're sort of talking about economic progress and development, and it certainly does. There was a bubble. There was I haven't heard scholars some scholars describe it, but it's often described by policy people, sort of a bubble that kind of got the brunt of the economic crisis in the mid-80s into the mid-90s. So there were, you know, still families. I mean, I know from my research in New York City, the median family size of the 100 women that I interviewed in my pregnancy study, they were coming from families of six siblings, and so were their spouses. There were still, you know, large families well suited to an agricultural lifestyle, and then that wasn't viable anymore. And you saw the peso crisis, you saw the drought, which affected the parts of central Mexico, which sent people to New Jersey and New York, Oaxaca, Puebla, and Guerrero states, and the peso devaluation and all of the shenanigans with the 94 presidential election, and it all just sort of created what many people call kind of a perfect storm that produced the intensification of migration from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s. And that's when we see the peak numbers of Mexican migration to the whole country.
And at the same time, declining birth cohorts.
So now within a generation, we've seen now Mexico's birth rate is 2.2 per woman. So it's...
That's very familiar from the history of European migration. Early 20th century, that articulation of profound demographic
And the tapering off of migration. Yeah, and it's been a lot of factors. I mean, there's definitely been proactive social planning, and there's, you know, kind of interesting. I've stumbled across some websites of, you know, kind of the Catholic Church trying to push back against it, and I'm sure that's also true in Europe. They didn't have websites, but there's yeah, it's been very dramatic. And there's just a ton of talk. And Jennifer Hirsch is an anthropologist who's worked on this significantly in terms of looking at Georgia, Mexican families outside of Atlanta, and also in western Mexico and Jalisco State, and ideas about the perfect family size. And they're very broadly spread. In fact, in many cases, this kind of the cultural influence is coming from Mexico to Mexican families residing in the U.S. about what's the perfect family and how many one should have, the number of children that one can provide for, not the number of children that God sends. And so there's this sort of very overt kind of the Mexican ambassador no one tell her I said this because it wasn't on the record. But she said at one event, it was a room full of people, so someone else might have spilled the beans. But she said, it's the demography, stupid, which I thought was just one of the most brilliant quotes ever, kind of playing off of Perot and NAFTA. But she said, why is anybody worried about migration? It's over. It's done. There's no reason to worry about this anymore. And it's also an effective quote for talking about Latino, influence and things in New York City and in the United States. But that demographic transition was envisioned to have, to be perfectly timed with the economic transition and what was going to happen in terms of absorbing, the youth into a new kind of economy where, there would be smaller numbers of youth, more highly educated, and going into the service and manufacturing economy. And increasingly, it's become clear that there's a gap. There's, surplus youth that are not migrating or, being incorporated. There's a term that they use a lot, the ninis. Ni estudian ni trabajan. They neither study nor work. Kind of the in-between. What is it?
Waithood.
Oh, that's an interesting word.
Alicia, I was wondering, it came from your opening vignette that you're thinking about Narcos as very much a part of downtown capitalism. But we can see very clearly how the state fits into it through its very explicit discourses and policies. So how do the Narcos fit in with how you're thinking about capitalism?
Yeah.
As affecting real communities?
Yeah. I think it's kind of the cloud is kind of being chipped away by the minute with the news that's emerging after Ayotzinapa. I think that it's become, there's several memes that have sort of emerged and taken over Twitter in the last weeks, but one of the most common ones is Fue el Estado, it was the state, in terms of who disappeared the students. And so there's an increasing willingness, I think, maybe not even increasing, maybe sort of an unprecedented willingness to point fingers at the state for collaborating with the Narcos. And the excuses before Ayotzinapa were that, it's just bad apples. There's corrupt police officers who collaborate with the Narcos that take bribes, but it's not systemic. And I think Ayotzinapa has really made clear that it is completely systemic and far more pervasive than anyone would have probably guessed. And so I think it's becoming increasingly clear that they're one and the same. And so I think that, there's, as far as models for thinking about it, like Naomi Klein's, shock doctrine, I think Mexico has long sort of been considered to have been exempt from a lot of our thinking about Latin American, post-authoritarianism. And sometimes people have linked 1968 with, the dirty wars in other countries. But it's been sort of an argument that's had to be made. And I think now we're seeing that Mexico very clearly fits into post-authoritarian, shock capitalism models in ways that I don't think we had really, at least I hadn't really, been as convinced by until now. And so I think we'll start to see more of that. And, for me, I think, it's the basic premise, follow the money, you know, where, kind of, who does it benefit, you know, who's profiting by the status quo, you know, and we'll start to be able to make more sense of it, I think.
Would you think a common look at this so-called amnesty or executive order of President Obama using E-Verify, how will look this will be happening probably in a few months, maybe a few weeks. How does look this project? Do you know how look this project?
I've only just been hearing about it recently. I mean, it's just gotten into the papers recently. It sounds like the plan is to give some sort of they've had the deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA, which they started a couple of years ago, I guess, which is meant for young people who were brought to the U.S. as children but who were not citizens, to give them the right to be in the country and to have certain benefits but not actually guarantee them any sort of citizenship or path to citizenship, but just sort of having an extended period of not deporting them. And it sounds like what Obama is going to propose is something along the lines of that for parents of citizen children, which would be a great thing because there are many, many families that are torn apart by deportations. And so allowing those parents to stay in the U.S. To come out would be, in my opinion, a positive effect, though it falls far short of any sort of comprehensive reform or any sort of pathway to citizenship that a real meaningful or lasting reform would. These sort of deferred action things are usually 1 or 2 years renewable, but they require you to make yourself publicly known. You have to report your presence to the authorities, and if you're somebody who's been living here for 15, 20 years, not on the radar of any government organization, then coming forward like that can be very frightening in the same way that these other technologies are. So it remains to be seen. I don't know. The details have not come out. I don't know if you know any more.
Yeah.
About this.
One of the key pieces of DACA has been the work permits, and I assume this would include work permits as well. So that's a big deal, but right. I have a feeling there's going to be, for the reasons you say, less uptake among the parents because the idea that it could all be overturned with another president of differing viewpoints or by Congress, I think it's going to make people reluctant. Parents probably rightly would imagine themselves having less moral ground to stand on, arguing with the right in terms of why they should be allowed to stay than students who've grown up their whole lives here. Rightly or wrongly, I think they have lots of moral ground to stand on. But the argument will be more difficult to make in the press that they should be extended any sort of benefit.
I'd also like to discuss the patchwork concept a little bit more. I think it's true that different localities are dealing with immigration differently. And when we just talk in terms of national tendencies, we leave that out. But the challenge is to understand why. And I mean, you talk about activism as being part of it, but I wonder if you could say more about that, because I mean, if you look across the U.S., you see there are, I mean, cities in the Midwest, like Dayton, Ohio, that say, immigrants, please come here, we need you, and the National League of Cities celebrates immigrant entrepreneurs that invites them to rebuild the city. So while there's this national anti-immigrant discourse, it's very important to see there's these local counter-narratives.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have to understand what it is that makes those counter-narratives, and if it's a source for a political base for organizing.
Right. Well, here I would be ethnographic in my response and say that it requires an understanding of the history of New Jersey, which may not be that interesting to most
people, but to me it is. And that really involves a history of these very small autonomous towns side by side. One of the biggest problems, one of the reasons why New Jersey has a real budget crisis is every town, and these can be very small towns side by side, has its own school district, has its own fire department, its own trash, its own everything. They call it duplication of services. And it's got its own sense of identity, right? Identity is very locally based. And say of New Jersey, there is no sense of New Jersey, of like the state, the identity of New Jersey, right? It's probably one reason why it's often the butt of jokes in the media and so on. And it's really part of the history of being torn between or positioned between these two major metropoles, one to the north, one to the south, and there's New Jersey in the middle. And there's also to get really into the history of central New Jersey and Monmouth County, a tradition of freeholders with stakes in the land, answering back to the crown of England. New Jersey was, this goes back to what Jerry was saying, New Jersey was the last northern state, I think, to free slaves, to abolish slavery. Very rural, agrarian history, and a sense of local self-rule. So all of those things, I think today we see, you know, immigration is just one issue within this whole.
Yeah, but if it was just New Jersey, why would Dayton, Ohio be doing the same?
Well, I'm not saying New Jersey's unique. I'm describing the situation of New Jersey. I don't know anything about Dayton, Ohio. I'm sure you can find similar kinds of things in other places.
All I'm saying is, like, it's really our challenge is to try to understand why what's places that would seem pretty different in Manchester, New Hampshire, Dayton, Ohio, and wherever, hometown, New Jersey, end up, despite all the national discourse and the technology, deciding that they want and being immigrant friendly, becoming sanctuaries.
Yeah.
And what combination of factors ties us together, they're different.
Right.
No, that's very interesting, and you need to do some kind of real comparative study. I know in New Jersey there have been many towns that have followed suit, that have successfully implemented these anti-immigrant policies. One of them is Riverside, New Jersey, which was a very lively town in southern New Jersey, had a very robust economy. They made it impossible for immigrants to look for work on the streets. And immigrant-owned businesses closed up. You couldn't rent property anymore. If you go to Riverside today, it's dead. It's utterly desolate. And if you go to towns that are much more open to immigrants, you find that they're actually... There's an economic component that probably has a lot to do with that, and the extent to which you have an administration or townspeople who recognize that. Right?
I think also there's been a lot of really good reporting about how a lot of the anti-immigrant ordinances around the country are not as homegrown as they seem. You know, Chris Kobach is, you know, one of the architects of legislation that's been literally copied and pasted in state legislatures around the country, and there's others writing the local municipal legislation and creating this seemingly spontaneous wave of anti-immigrant legislation in lots of states and municipalities. And I think the pro-immigrant legislation, I saw once the account that said that actually pro-immigrant legislation acts outnumber anti-immigrant legislation acts, even though they don't get as much publicity usually. I think it's been a little bit of a reaction to the anti-immigrant legislation to try to carve out safe spaces at the same time that some of the anti-immigrant legislation is creating, you know, very high-risk zones.
And the incredible failures in places like Alabama, where agriculture has really suffered from these very restrictive laws that have been put into play.
Starting from the point that New Jersey had the highest Klan membership of any state in the country starting in the 1920s, I mean, that was the center of Klan activity. I was thinking that could it be that what you're describing, both the fear and the rooting of capitalism in the bodies of people, is general, is not, I mean, maybe the undocumented workers are the current or perhaps the more intense case, but if you think of lynching, which didn't end until the 1950s, if you think of all the people who work for minimum wage with no health insurance and the fear, the terror that their kids will get sick, that they will get sick, that a tooth will rot, that, you know, I mean, the terror in their bodies of trying to make it on minimum wage, it may be that capitalism in general works on this terror, and this is just...
Absolutely. And I think also in Ferguson we see, you know, I mean, a lot of cross connections, and I think your comments are pushing for more of those cross connections, which I think are very fruitful. But, you know, in Ferguson, you know, for, I think that out of all of Missouri, and Missouri is not, you know, doesn't have a stellar record of this, but Ferguson was, I think, the worst in terms of charging people outrageous fines for, you know, parking in the wrong spots on residential streets or for ordinary kind of licensing business with the municipality. It was sort of the way that they generated income. And Matt Taibbi's book, Divided, talks about, you know, the little fees, you know, that people get charged when they get a ticket or when they get charged with a minor crime, and all of the fees that are generated, or when they're charged, you know, for making a phone call from city jail, or, you know, all of these little costs that are now massive income generators. And as we see the prison industrial complex sort of begin to be dismantled a little bit by the rolling back of Rockefeller drug laws, et cetera, we've seen a ramping up of the use of those same sorts of structures for immigrant detention in the same private companies that were making money off of the prison boom are now, you know, shifting into immigrant detention. And then the technologies on the border, not just, you know, E-Verify, but, you know, the drones and the all the other kinds of, you know, military technologies that are being repurposed to detain and have surveillance of poor bodies of color, both immigrant and non.
There are a number of anthropologists now writing about precarity as a condition of post-Fordist capitalism, right? And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. And the undocumented person is sort of the hyper example of a precarious condition, but which is now revealing itself to be much more widespread and not entirely linked to citizenship, non-citizenship, and so on.
Last question by Peter. During the massive Italian migrations, South Italian migrations, various Sicilian, I happen to know, organized crime families had a presence in immigrant communities in the United States, engaging in labor racketeering, job brokering, gambling, organizing gambling. Both numbers and other forms of gambling. Is there any indication that the cartels, Los Zetas and the Sinaloa cartels, have the same kind of presence in established migrant communities in this country now?
Yeah, definitely.
I'm surprised if they weren't.
Yeah. From things like recruiting mules and various tasks, I guess, that have to be accomplished when you're trying to sell drugs. But also, they're engaged with part of the problem of the lack of immigration reform is that it has sort of thrown everyone into the same channels. So we have the drugs and the immigrants and the weapons kind of going through exactly the same pathways, and oftentimes being managed by the same brokers. And so the coyotes, who used to be considered sort of a trustworthy, you know, figure who would get you safely from point A to point B, now are obliged, even when they don't want to work in these larger networks, and those stretch, you know, everywhere in the United States. So immigrants now are not, you know, deposited on the northern side of the border. They're brought to oftentimes, you know, holding places and then eventually turned over to their family, but there's extortion at every step of the path, and somebody's, you know, the money is changing hands at every step of the path as they're passed from person to person along this route. And so the cartels are completely, I think, in charge of that trafficking.
But also in places like Dayton or gambling, small little gambling establishments or numbers rackets.
I'm not sure.
Local services, in effect.
I'm not sure about that. I know that there's fear among a lot of immigrant families that if you don't pay off your debts to your smuggler, that you know that you're not going to be immune from doing so. You're not going to get away with it. But I'm not sure.
And there's also the capturing and ransoming back then of migrants. So you have these transnational networks of extortion of the mafia, essentially, operations. Having the relatives of people who they've detained in the desert pay these ransoms in sort of an ongoing way.
Right. And some of the, it hasn't been widespread in the reporting on what's happening in Guerrero right now, but that region where the students disappeared is the number one opium poppy cultivation location in the world right now, I think. Something like 85% of the heroin in the U.S. is cultivated in that region from some of the reports that I've read. So it's all very much interwoven.
Well, I would like to thank Daniel and Lisa for a really interesting panel tonight.